Chemical Watch podcast.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch, intelligence to transform product safety.
Hello, and welcome to the Chemical Watch podcast. I'm North America reporter Julia John, and today we're bringing you a special deep dive into U.S. regulations on per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAS, in products. Joining us for this discussion are Lauren Tambor from Washington Department of Ecology's Hazardous Waste and Toxics Reduction Program, Lori Valeriano, Toxic Free Futures Executive Director, and Katie Skaggs, a Keller & Heckman partner. This year, states across the country have passed restrictions on PFAS in goods ranging from firefighting foam to fabric treatments. Vermont, Connecticut, and Minnesota have followed Washington State, Maine, and New York's lead in embracing bans on these compounds in food packaging. Meanwhile, California has begun regulating PFAS in carpets and rugs, and Vermont and Maine will do so starting in 2023. Maine even plans to phase out unnecessary PFAS uses by 2030. So, what should companies do to prepare for compliance with all these upcoming regulations? And what do regulators want or need from industry, consumers, and other stakeholders as they prepare to implement these laws?
This is Lori. I'll jump in there. I mean, I think For the past few years, you know, there's been increased regulation of PFAS and, you know, on the entire class in main product categories. And I think that companies, have been preparing and companies are looking at their use of PFAS and seeing the handwriting on the wall. So I think that, you know, really companies need to be, if they're still using PFAS, and many are, they need to be talking to suppliers to find out, you know, what other alternatives that are safer can be used, and they need to start phasing it out, particularly in uses, you know, that we see that are going to be further regulated, like in the textile realm. So we're talking about apparel and upholstery and all the products that we, you know, that we have in our homes where PFAS is used, so, or offices. So I think that that's what companies should be doing.
You know, I work closely with members of industry on these issues. This is Katie. And I think what companies should be doing is getting very familiar with the laws that have been passed so far and you know, really considering the definitions under those laws, because they vary from state to state and different things are required from state to state. So if we think about Washington, you know, their ban on PFAS in food packaging is really focused on packaging derived from plant fibers, so paper and paperboard packaging. Same goes for New York, whereas other state bans are broader and pertain to food packaging more generally. But even within the food packaging definitions, there are nuances, and companies should become familiar with how food packaging has been defined from state to state to figure out if these laws do indeed apply to them. And of course, start considering the PFAS definition, which is quite broad in almost every case. It's going to apply to things that have a fully fluorinated carbon atom. And so, you know, while companies may have done their due diligence to confirm in the past that they have a PFAS that is cleared by FDA and is authorized for use in food contact applications, now these laws are going beyond that and may, you know, require more scrutiny.
This is Lori, and I would just jump in and echo what Katie said. I'm a little biased answering this question as someone who oversees a stakeholder involvement campaign, but I think companies can stay informed by getting involved with the stakeholder processes that government agencies like mine use to implement laws. I know that's resource intensive and can't work for every company, but if you can devote some time to perusing Chemical Watch or attending webinars or other engagement events as agencies implement laws, you can not only stay informed, but you can also contribute to those implementation processes and help ensure that they're reasonable.
I think that's important. This is Lori. And I also think that if companies really, you know, were proactive and saw the handwriting on the wall when it came to PFAS, they would be proactively getting out of it. And then they don't have to worry about the regulations on PFAS, and they could save a lot of money, you know, trying to comply and figuring out whether or not, you know, it applies to them. It's the bottom line is these chemicals should not be in all the products they're in today. It's just, and the companies are seeing that. I mean, we're seeing that in the marketplace. So while I agree that it's important to understand how the laws impact you, it's also, it's so clear that these chemicals need to be on their way out.
Yeah. So the thing is that, you know, some industry groups like the American Chemistry Council warn that moving away from PFAS in products will place a big burden on businesses and regulators. So, you know, what challenges await states and industry as PFAS prohibitions become effective?
This is Lori. States right now are facing enormous cleanup costs with respect to these chemicals. There's no other greater burden. I mean, we're looking at a $10 billion budget add in the infrastructure package to deal with cleanup of PFAS in drinking water, which is critically needed. But I don't know how you compare, you know, to that. We're spending huge amounts of money to clean up these chemicals. That's what's burdensome. And, you know, phasing them out and finding safer alternatives, especially where the chemicals don't need to be used at all, is really the solution. And that's where we're going to save money. We're going to protect health, and we're going to, you know, make the biggest progress. So I think the challenge is really for states to proactively ID these sources of PFAS in products and in the environment and start eliminating them. And banning them. That's the best solution, and finding the safest alternatives and making sure there's no regrettable substitutes.
This is Katie. And, you know, I think the trap that is involved when you start banning chemicals that play an important role in consumer products or other products that are on the market is, you know, banning something that has downsides without determining if there's an alternative that you're comfortable with. And I know that's an important element of the Washington state law. So I'm sure Lauren has some additions to make here. But, you know, we can't just remove chemicals from the market. And I think this is what ACC is really getting at, unless we know what they'll be replaced with. If we have something that's playing a critical role in the function of products, as PFAS is in many cases, it will have to be replaced by something. And there's a lot of other countervailing considerations, like the safety of that alternative, its availability, how well it performs, you know, what happens to food safety when you replace that chemistry, and then what's the new impact on the environment? Are these replacements recyclable? Are they as sustainable? And then what are the costs of that to states and to consumers and to industry? So, you know, there's a lot of countervailing considerations when you're talking about banning a whole class of chemicals. It's not to downplay anything you've said, Lori, by any stretch of the imagination, but, you know, there's a lot of other things that we have to consider when we're talking about wholesale replacement of a class of chemicals. And I think that's what ACC has really been emphasizing with its recent comments.
Yeah, adding on to that, Katie, I would echo. It's exactly why we have invested so many resources within our state government in Washington to find those alternatives that are safer than the class we're looking at, feasible to use in the product and actually available on the market before we adopt any potential restrictions. We wouldn't require a manufacturer to use a specific alternative, but if we can find those alternatives that manufacturers already use for the same or a similar application, we can give producers options for making that transition more effectively if we do adopt regulations. And then if other states can leverage that work and we can leverage theirs, it's even better.
Yeah, I mean, this is Lori. I was the lead advocate on the all the bills on PFAS in Washington state, as well as the Safer Products for Washington law, and that has been a fundamental principle of our policy approach in Washington state, which is to evaluate the alternatives and to ensure there are safer alternatives. So I absolutely agree with you on that. I also think that, you know, our agency is finding, you know, that alternatives that aren't great, and they should also be regulated, and our state should have the authority to regulate those regrettable substitutes as well. And it's really the policy approach that is the most rational out there, because you can really look at all aspects of the alternative and not just be focused on one particular aspect. So that's why I think that Washington State is really a model, not only for, you know, other states, but for, you know, national reform, where we really should be, you know, focused on what is the safest alternative, what's the safest solution, and not just banning, you know, chemical by chemical or even class by class.
And I'll just point out that, you know, in Connecticut, although their state ban on PFAS in food packaging does not encompass an alternatives assessment, they do have a provision in their law that says no material used to replace a chemical that's being regulated, such as PFAS, should be used in a quantity or manner that creates a hazard as great or greater than what's being regulated. So they're certainly thinking along the same lines.
So then what do you do when, you know, you say, you know, when you're finding that viable PFAS-free replacements don't exist? As we talked about, you know, Washington State has been looking at this, and they said that they couldn't find those kinds of alternatives for four food packaging types. So how can producers replace the compounds in goods while avoiding regrettable substitutions with equally or more harmful substances?
I think we need to be clear about, can I just, in terms of that statement, that's not exactly what the state found. I mean, the state found safer alternatives for all of the all of the product categories that they looked at. What the challenge was on when they looked at the cost and where they set their bar on the cost and where they set their bar with respect to availability. And our law was a little bit ahead of the marketplace at that time, but now it's just not the case. And for, you know, all the alternative, you know, all the product categories that they looked at, the material, you know, alternatives are absolutely there. It's, you know, kaolin-coated products, uncoated products, wax-coated products, PLA, you know, plastic. I mean, it's... the alternatives are there. It was just, you know, the way that the agency was able to get the information and where they set the bar. But, you know, they're doing a second round on that, and Lauren can speak to that.
Yeah, I would just add to that. Lori's right. Our report did not find that no viable alternatives exist to PFAS in food packaging. As Lori mentioned, we found a safer alternative for all the options of food packaging we assessed. What the report results meant was that more time was needed in the market to ensure that those viable alternatives were cost-effective and available in enough supply. And again, as Lori mentioned, our team immediately started work to find alternatives and more types of packaging. We're going to publish another report before the end of the year, and the market is shifting rapidly. There are going to be more products available to support that assessment. To get to kind of the second portions of that question, I think the best way for producers to ensure they're not replacing PFAS with another harmful substance is to do the due diligence in their supply chains to find out what's really being added to products. Asking suppliers for safety data sheets is a good place to start. But yes, again, as Lori mentioned, we did find viable alternatives for food packaging, including clay-coated and wax-coated materials, and additionally just some uncoated food packaging as well.
Katie, did you have anything to add?
No, I mean, I think that makes good sense. Obviously, you know, Washington has taken a good deal of stakeholder input into the alternatives assessment, which is really essential, because I think a lot of times, you know, we need those perspectives from across the board, industry included, to really understand whether an alternative is viable and what the impacts are going to be on food safety. And, you know, I think for members of industry that are under obligations to produce food contact materials that will not adulterate food, that's really a primary concern. And they're, you know, very much focused on how these replacements will impact the safety and technical suitability of what they're making. And I know that's a focus for all stakeholders.
All right, so now let's move on and talk about regulations being adopted, generally having, you know, grouping hundreds or thousands of different PFAS into a single class. Environmental and public health advocates support such comprehensive consideration. And then they also say that, you know, we shouldn't have non-essential PFAS applications. So does the class and essentiality-based approach make sense, or do we need a narrower strategy focused on specific substances and uses to address PFAS in consumer goods?
This is Katie. The class-based approach is definitely a challenge. I think everybody here recognizes that not all chemicals that fall into the PFAS definition, which is being defined extremely broadly as a class of fluorinated chemicals that contain at least one fully fluorinated carbon atom, they're not all created equal. And, you know, many PFAS compounds that are being used in the marketplace are actually very high molecular weight polymers, and they're cross-linked heavily, and they don't really pose any plausible potential for migration to food or even uptake by the cells when they're ingested. And these are the conclusions that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration has reached on a host of PFAS compounds for specific applications in contact with food. So it is a challenge that they're being grouped together. I recognize, and from listening to various state hearings on this legislation, that legislators may not have the tools they need to separate one PFAS from another, and that would pose a regulatory challenge. But we are grouping things that are very different and pose very different, migration properties and toxicological risks. And, you know, of course, we see a lot of agencies now, EPA, the CDC, really putting efforts to understanding the toxicological differences of these PFAS, but the bans that are going into place are not distinguishing in any respect these differences.
This is Lori. The class-based approach is not really, you know, that new. I mean, PCBs are regulated as a class, you know, other chemicals. I think when it comes to PFAS, especially for our state, when they looked at it, the fact that they're so highly persistent and mobile really was a huge driver. And you can't just look at, you know, the final product, or when you're looking at this issue, you really have to look at the path of pollution. You know, you have to look at the manufacturing facilities that are, you know, making these chemicals and what they're putting into the, you know, into the surface waters or to the landfill or to the community. And there's significant PFAS contamination when you look at the facilities themselves in these communities. Then you look at, okay, well, then the PFAS, in the case of food packaging, it goes to a paper mill, a specialty paper mill. And then, you know, what is that? You know, what are those discharges? And we know what they are, you know, to some degree from FDA information. And it's significant. You know, what are the chemicals that are even used to make PFAS to begin with? I mean, these are highly hazardous chemicals made from harmful, you know, chemicals. And then you use the product, you know, and then for a few minutes, and then you throw it away and it winds up in a landfill or incinerator where it then causes, you know, persistent pollution forever. I mean, it just, you have to look at the whole picture when it comes to these chemicals. And that's why really, when you look at why you regulate as a class, it's because of that. And it's because of the high persistence and high mobility. And you're looking at not just the chemical in the product. So I think it makes a lot of sense. I also think it makes a lot of sense to figure out where they don't need to be used and there are safer alternatives, and to start to phase those in, because we know the damage they are causing. I mean, look at firefighting foam in drinking water. Look at, you know, the concern that around food packaging going into compost. These are legacy problems that we're going to have to deal with for a long time. And so just from a common sense perspective, looking at where we can phase them out rapidly, find safer alternatives, phase them in, and ultimately, you know, have safer solutions that are you know, rational that meet the basic needs it's just common sense.
And yeah, Lauren, what's the regulator's perspective on this?
Yeah, absolutely. Of course, Lori was instrumental in helping to get past the law that the program I primarily work on is working to implement. So I won't add a ton of additional extra context here to her. But, you know, the law we're implementing tells us to use a class-based approach, but I would say that my team generally agrees with that. We know that it's the best way to avoid assuming that chemicals without any data are safe and to prevent regrettable substitutions where we replace a dangerous chemical with something equally as toxic. And as Lori mentioned, there's even more support for this approach when it comes to the class of PFAS, because we know these chemicals are either persistent or break down to persistent chemicals, and there have already been regrettable substitutions with the class. So absolutely recognize that there's variability within chemical classes, and this is definitely one of the key questions related to toxic chemical regulation. But there's been a lot of research and support for this approach across different chemical and product regulations, and we do think it's the best fit for our Safer Products for Washington program.
And then what would you say is needed to determine what the essential use of PFAS is? Is there potential for consumers here, or for consensus here among states, industry, and the NGO community to, you know, decide what actually is essential?
This is a really good question. This is Lauren from Ecology. I would say from our program's perspective, what's really needed to determine what an essential use is stakeholder involvement. Manufacturers, producers, and end users of products are all going to come to that conversation with different perspectives about what they need in terms of that product's performance. In our program, we try to involve as many stakeholders as possible so that we can truly understand the different performance needs and what's driving the use of specific chemicals. You know, for example, when it comes to PFAS in home furnishings like couches, we're finding that some manufacturers making PFAS refurnishings didn't replace PFAS with another chemical for stain resistance treatment. The handful of manufacturers we spoke to simply removed the PFAS treatment altogether, did not replace it with anything, and they didn't hear feedback from their customers noticing the change. I think that leads to some really important questions about whether the chemical was necessary in the first place.
Yeah, that's a really good example, Lauren. I think there's a lot of examples like that. We see it used in so many products, particularly textiles and apparel and home furnishings, and you know, where you can use a spot stain, or you can cannot use anything at all, but our homes are, you know, have it in the carpet and rugs, it's in the textiles, and our, you know, in our couches, it's in our bedrooms. I mean, those are not essential, and neither is food packaging. As you know, as you look at alternatives, it's very obvious when you start to say, okay, what are the alternatives to these uses? Is it not necessary at all? Are there safer alternatives? You realize it's not essential, and you can, and that changes over time too. So it's not a stagnant thing. I mean, what today might not be, you know, available for a medical device, maybe eventually, but it's a changing thing, and the market responds to the, you know, to regulatory and consumer demands, supply chain demands. And so it's an evolving thing. But I think what we need to agree to is that these chemicals are extremely problematic, and we need to reduce their use as much as possible. Like, and really drive to the safest alternatives and safer solutions by using, you know, the assessment approaches that states like Washington are using. I think we just need to come to the agreement, it's really about just solving this problem. And if anybody says we don't have a problem when we're spending $10 billion on cleanup of water we have a problem.
Yeah, I think, you know, where what other regulatory schemes have focused on in terms of essentiality is really about whether something can be used when it's really necessary for health or safety or critical functioning of society. And you know, whether something is posing an unacceptable risk to human health or the environment. There are certainly examples that, you know, Lori and Lauren have offered where, you know, essentiality might be in question. And yet there are other examples where, you know, we have to, I think, allow for flexibility. You mentioned medical devices. I certainly know from, you know, talking to test laboratories that we work with that laboratory wear can be an important use of PFAS chemistries because they have very unique inert properties and low extractables and compatibility with a variety of chemicals and extreme temperatures that just do not have replacements at this time. And I think that's why, you know, laws like Washington State that have this idea of an alternatives assessment are really important. And look, over the last year or two, we've been in this pandemic, which was, you know, totally unexpected. And we see that essentiality can fluctuate depending on what's going around, you know, what's going on in the world around us. And more than ever, there's been the need for disposable food service ware and, you know, having safe and effective disposable food service ware took on a prominence that I think none of us really expected, and was driven by something that we didn't see coming. So, you know, I think essentiality really has to be flexible to allow for changing circumstances, and it has to take into account how critical that chemical is in the applications where it's being used.
Yeah, I think that makes sense. And I mean, I think, but I think the ultimate goal needs to be, you know, reducing and eliminating as much as possible. I mean, we just did a peer-reviewed study looking at breast milk in 50 women in Washington and found PFAS in 100% of the samples. And what's more disturbing is that, you know, we found the PFAS, the newer generation PFAS that are in current use. We're not just talking about legacy PFAS. So, and we're looking at detections, and the detections are, you know, are doubling every, you know, every four or five years. And that's a problem. And if it wasn't so pervasive in all the products we have in our homes and our offices, we shouldn't be finding these PFAS in breast milk. It just, they shouldn't be there. And so we absolutely think that, you know, we're going to see more bans, we're going to see phase outs of non-essential uses. And I think in particular, you know, because textiles is such a large use, that's definitely a concerning use, as well as, you know, things like waxes and polishes that are used, you know, in homes and daycares and other places. So I think we're going to see more and more activity at the state level, the federal level, at all levels to solve the PFAS crisis.
All right. Well, yeah, that ties into my next and last question, which is, do you predict additional blanket bans and a complete phase out of non-essential PFAS uses in the future? And if not, what applications and what regions of the country could see further regulation?
This is Lauren. I can jump in on this one. I mean, of course, I can't speculate on future regulations, but there's definitely growing awareness of the potential negative outcomes resulting from all these cumulative exposures to toxic chemicals that we're experiencing from products. There are also some really promising voluntary actions that chemical and product manufacturers are taking themselves. The public and state legislators are growing in their awareness of the issue. That really gives us hope for improving public and environmental health in the future. But at Department of Ecology, where I can anticipate our potential future work, you can definitely expect a continued focus on this chemical class from our hazardous waste and toxics reduction program, whether that's through our food packaging work, implementing our PFAS chemical action plan, or the product regulations that we're talking about today. We know there's already contamination in our state, so we're aiming to find ways to reduce those sources of exposure from consumer products if we can.
Yeah, I'll just add that, this is Katie, I'll just add that there is a lot of federal activity going on to reduce PFAS exposures in the environment, particularly at the Environmental Protection Agency. They're rolling out, you know, all manner of proposed rules on PFAS reporting and record keeping. There's a bill moving through Congress, the PFAS Action Act of 2021, that would call on EPA to do much, much more on PFAS in the environment and remediation of PFAS in the environment. And so what I'll be curious to see is what states do, or what states continue to do once, if and when these EPA actions start to have the desired effect on PFAS in the environment. You know, I think from industry's perspective, it's always challenging to navigate a patchwork of state laws. And, you know, I think the desired approach would be to have more uniformity. And in the absence of federal action, states have taken action. That's no surprise. But as the federal government takes more action, it will be interesting to see what impact that has and whether that sort of alleviates the need for the patchwork of state bans and activity.
Yeah, I think that the EPA's, you know, framework is limited in terms of being able to really address PFAS the way we need it to be addressed. And so I think we will continue to see states, take action from a precautionary approach. Anything from requiring, you know, disclosure to phasing out non-essential uses, looking at safer alternatives, phasing those in. And then also, I mean, the states are just doing way more work when it comes to truly finding solutions especially identifying safer alternatives. And I don't think that EPA is doing that. And the states have always been ahead of EPA on these issues. And I think Congress is, you know, looking at doing some good bills that phase out PFAS in products, and that's good. But I do not see the states slowing down at all.
All right. Yeah, I guess we'll see what happens. I'm sure there will be a lot of action to watch going forward. And that's all the time that we have for this episode. But thank you again to Katie, Lori, and Lauren for sharing their US PFAS product regulation insights with us and contributing to a very lively conversation. And thank you to our audience for listening. For more on the subjects we explored, please visit the Chemical Watch website, chemicalwatch.com. And don't forget to catch our next news podcast in 2 weeks.
Unlock the full value of your compliance and product stewardship with world-leading insight and intelligence from Chemical Watch. To find out more or request a demo, visit chemicalwatch.com. Chemical Watch, intelligence to transform product safety.
The Chemical Watch Podcast.